Amar la quinza bandam nunca haría su
57. Whitey's mom works in Fedland. She has parked her little car in her own little numbered slot, for which the feds require her to pay about 10% of her salary. If she doesn't like it, she can take a taxi or a walk. And walked up several levels of a blindingly lit, reinforced concrete helix, in which most of the spaces, the good spaces closer to the surface, are reserved for people other than her, but empty. She always walks up the center of the ramp, between the rows of parked cars, so that the EBGOC boys won't think she's lurking, loitering, skulking, malingering, or smoking. Reaching the subterranean entrance of her building, she has taken all metal objects from her pockets and removed what little jewelry she's wearing and dumped them into a dirty plastic bowl and walked through the detector. Flashed her badge, signed her name and noted down the digital time. Submitted to a frisking from an EBGOC girl. Annoying, but it sure beats a cavity search. They have the right to do a cavity search if they want. She got cavity searched every day for a month once, right after she had spoken up at a meeting and suggested that her supervisor might be on the wrong track with a major programming project. It was punitive and vicious, she knew it was. But she always wanted to give something back to her country. And whenever you work for the feds, you just accept the fact that there's going to be some politicking. And that as a low-level person, you're going to bear the brunt. And later on, you climb the GS ladder, don't have to put up with as much shit. Far be it from her to quarrel with her supervisor. Her supervisor, Marietta, doesn't have an especially stellar GS level, but she does have access. She has connections. Marietta knows people who know people. Marietta has attended cocktail parties that were also attended by some people who, well, your eyes would bug out. She has passed the frisking with flying colors, put the metal stuff back into her pockets, climbed up half a dozen flights of stairs to her floor. The elevators here still work, but some very highly placed people in Fedland have let it be known, nothing official, but they always have ways of letting this stuff out, that it is a duty to conserve energy. And the feds are real serious about duty. Duty, loyalty, responsibility. The collagen that binds us into the United States of America. So the stairwells are filled with sweaty wool and clacking leather. If you took the elevator, no one would actually say anything, but it would be noticed. Noticed and written down and taken into account. People would look at you, glance you up and down like, "What happened? Sprained your ankle?" Taking the stairs is no problem. Feds don't smoke. Feds generally don't overeat. The health plan is very specific, contains major incentives. Get too heavy or wheezy, and no one says anything about it, which would be rude, but you feel a definite pressure, a sense of not fitting in. As you walk across the sea of desks, eyes glance up to follow you, estimating the mass of your saddlebags, eyes darting back and forth between desks, as by consensus, your co-workers say to themselves, "I wonder how much he or she is driving up our health plan premiums." So YT's mom has clacked up the stairs in her black pumps and gone into her office. Actually, a large room with computer workstations placed across it in a grid. Used to be divided up by partitions, but the EBGOC boys didn't like it, said, what would happen if there had to be an evacuation? All those partitions would impede the free flow of unhinged panic. So no more partitions, just workstations and chairs. Not even any desktops. Desktops encourage the use of paper, which is archaic, and reflects inadequate team spirit. What is so special about your work that you have to write it down on a piece of paper that only you get to see? That you have to lock it away inside a desk? When you're working for the feds, everything you do is the property of the United States of America. You do your work on the computer. The computer keeps a copy of everything, so that if you get sick or something, it's all there, where your co-workers and supervisors can get access to it. If you want to write little notes or make phone doodles, you're perfectly free to do that at home, in your spare time. And there's the question of interchangeability. Fed workers, like military people, are intended to be interchangeable parts. What happens if your workstation should break down? You're going to sit there and twiddle your thumbs until it gets fixed? No siree. You're going to move to a spare workstation and get to work on that. And you don't have that flexibility if you've got half a ton of personal stuff cached inside of a desk, strewn around a desktop. So there is no paper in a Fed office. All the workstations are the same. You come in the morning, pick one at random, sit down, and get to work. You could try to favor a particular station, try to sit there every day, but it would be noticed. Generally, you pick the unoccupied workstation that's closest to the door. That way, whoever came in earliest sits closest, whoever came in latest is way in the back. For the rest of the day, it's obvious at a glance who's on the ball in this office and who is, as they whisper to each other in the bathrooms, having problems. Not that it's any big secret who comes in first. When you sign onto a workstation in the morning, it's not like the central computer doesn't notice that fact. The central computer notices just about everything. Keeps track of every key you hit on the keyboard all day long, what time you hit it, down to the microsecond, whether it was the right key or the wrong key, how many mistakes you make, and when you make them. You're only required to be at your workstation from 8 to 5, with a half-hour lunch break and 2 10-minute coffee breaks. But if you stuck to that schedule, it would definitely be noticed, which is why YT's mom is sliding into the first unoccupied workstation and signing onto her machine at 6:45. Half a dozen other people are already here, signed onto workstations closer to the entrance, but this isn't bad. She can look forward to a reasonably stable career if she can keep up this sort of performance. The Fed still operate in flat land. None of this three-dimensional stuff, no goggles, no stereo sound. The computers are all basic, flat-screen, two-dimensional numbers. Windows appear on the desktop with little text documents inside. All part of the austerity program, soon to reap major benefits. She signs on and checks her mail. No personal mail, just a couple of mass-distributed pronouncements from Marietta. New TP pool regulations. I've been asked to distribute the new regulations regarding office pool displays. The enclosed memo is a new subchapter of the EBGOC procedure manual, replacing the old subchapter entitled Physical Plant /California /Los Angeles /Buildings /Office Areas Physical Layout Regulations Employee Input Group Activities. The old subchapter was a flat prohibition on the use of office space or time for pool activities of any kind, whether permanent, e.g. coffee pool, or one-time, e.g. birthday parties. This prohibition still applies, but a single one-time exception has now been made for any office that wishes to pursue a joint bathroom tissue strategy. By way of introduction, let me just make a few general comments on this subject. The problem of distributing bathroom tissue to workers presents inherent challenges for any office management system due to the inherent unpredictability of usage. Not every facility usage transaction necessitates the use of bathroom tissue, and when it is used, the amount needed, number of squares, may vary quite widely from person to person, and, for a given person, from one transaction to the next. This does not even take into account the occasional use of bathroom tissue for unpredictable / creative purposes, such as applying, removing cosmetics, beverage spill management, etc. For this reason, rather than trying to package bathroom tissue in small one-transaction packets, as is done with pre-moistened towelettes, for example, which can be wasteful in some cases, and limiting in other cases, it has been traditional to package this product in bulk distribution units, whose size exceeds the maximum amount of squares that an individual could conceivably use in a single transaction, barring force majeure. This reduces to a minimum the number of transactions in which the distribution unit is depleted, the roll runs out, during the transaction. A situation that can lead to emotional stress for the affected employee. However, it does present the manager with some challenges in that the distribution unit is rather bulky and must be repeatedly used by a number of different individuals if it is not to be wasted. Since the implementation of Phase 17 of the austerity program, employees have been allowed to bring their own bathroom tissue from home. This approach is somewhat bulky and redundant, as every worker usually brings their own roll. Some offices have attempted to meet this challenge by instituting bathroom tissue pools. Without overgeneralizing, it may be stated that an inherent and irreducible feature of any bathroom tissue pool implemented at the office level, in an environment, i.e. building, in which comfort stations are distributed on a per-floor basis, i.e. in which several offices share a single facility, is that provision must be made within the confines of the individual office for temporary stationing of bathroom tissue distribution units, i.e. rolls. This follows from the fact that if the BTDUs, rolls, are stationed while inactive outside of the purview of the controlling office, i.e., the office that has collectively purchased the BTDU, that is, if the BTDUs are stored, for example, in a lobby area or within the facility in which they are actually utilized, they will be subject to pilferage and shrinkage as unauthorized persons consume them, either as part of a conscious effort to pilfer or out of an honest misunderstanding, i.e., a belief that the BTDUs are being provided free of charge by the operating agency, in this case, the United States government, or as the result of necessity, as in the case of a beverage spill that is encroaching on sensitive electronic equipment and whose management will thus brook no delay. This fact has led certain offices, which shall go unnamed, you know who you are, guys, to establish makeshift BTDU depots that also serve as pool contribution collection points. Usually these depots take the form of a table near the door closest to the facility, on which the BTDUs are stacked or otherwise deployed, with a bowl or some other receptacle in which participants may place their contributions, and typically with a sign or other attention-getting device, such as a stuffed animal or cartoon, requesting donations. A quick glance at the current regulations will show that placement of such a display depot violates the procedure manual. However, in the interests of employee hygiene, morale, and group spirit building, my higher-ups have agreed to make a one-time exception in the regulations for this purpose. As with any part of the procedure manual, new or old, it is your responsibility to be thoroughly familiar with this material. Estimated reading time for this document is 15.62 minutes, and don't think we won't check. Please make note of the major points made in this document as follows. 1. BTDU depot displays are now allowed on a trial basis, with the new policy to be reviewed in 6 months. 2. These must be operated on a voluntary pool-type basis as described in the subchapter on employee pools. Note, this means keeping books and tallying all financial transactions. 3. BTDUs must be brought in by the employees, not shipped through the mailroom, and are subject to all the usual search and seizure regulations. 4. Scented BTDUs are prohibited, as they may cause allergic reactions, wheezing, etc. in some persons. 5. Cash pool donations, as with all monetary transactions within the U.S. government, must use official U.S. currency, no yen or Kong bucks. Naturally, this will lead to a bulk problem if people try to use the donation bucket as a dumping ground for bundles of old billion and trillion dollar bills. The buildings and grounds people are worried about waste disposal problems and the potential fire hazard that may ensue if large piles of billions and trillions begin to mount up. Therefore, a key feature of the new regulation is that the donation bucket must be emptied every day. More often, if an excessive build-up situation is seen to develop. In this vein, the B&G people would also like me to point out that many of you who have excess U.S. currency to get rid of have been trying to kill two birds with one stone by using old billions as bathroom tissue. While creative, this approach has two drawbacks. One, it clogs the plumbing, and two, it constitutes defacement of U.S. currency, which is a federal crime. Don't do it. Join your office bathroom tissue pool instead. It's easy, it's hygienic, and it's legal. Happy pooling, Marietta. YT's mom pulls up the new memo, checks the time, and starts reading it. The estimated reading time is 15.62 minutes. Later, when Marietta does her end-of-day statistical roundup, sitting in her private office at 9 p.m., she will see the name of each employee and next to it the amount of time spent reading this memo. And her reaction, based on the time spent, will go something like this. Less than 10 minutes. Time for an employee conference and possible attitude counseling. 10 to 14 minutes. Keep an eye on this employee. Maybe developing slipshod attitude. 14 to 15.61 minutes. Employee is an efficient worker. May sometimes miss important details. Exactly 15.62 minutes. Smartass. Needs attitude counseling. 15.63 to 16 minutes. Asswipe. Not to be trusted. 16 to 18 minutes. Employee is a methodical worker. May sometimes get hung up on minor details. More than 18 minutes. Check the security videotape. See just what this employee was up to. E.g., possible unauthorized restroom break.
YT's mom decides to spend between 14 and 15 minutes reading the memo. It's better for younger workers to spend too long to show that they're careful, not cocky. It's better for older workers to go a little fast to show good management potential. She's pushing 40. She scans through the memo, hitting the page down button at reasonably regular intervals, occasionally paging back up to pretend to reread some earlier section. The computer is going to notice all this. It approves of rereading. It's a small thing, but over a decade or so, this stuff really shows up on your work habit summary. Having got that out of the way, she dives into work. She is an applications programmer for the feds. In the old days, she would have written computer programs for a living. Nowadays, she writes fragments of computer programs. These programs are designed by Marietta and Marietta's superiors in massive week-long meetings on the top floor. Once they get the design down, they start breaking up the problem into tinier and tinier segments, assigning them to group managers, who break them down even more and feed little bits of work to the individual programmers. In order to keep the work done by the individual coders from colliding, it all has to be done according to a set of rules and regulations even bigger and more fluid than the government procedure manual. So the first thing that YT's mother does, having read the new subchapter on bathroom tissue pools, is to sign on to a subsystem of the main computer system that handles the particular programming project she's working on. She doesn't know what the project is, that's classified, or what it's called. It's just her project. She shares it with a few hundred other programmers. She's not sure exactly who. And every day when she signs on to it, there's a stack of memos waiting for her, containing new regulations and changes to the rules that they all have to follow in writing code for the project. These regulations make the business with the bathroom tissue seem as simple and elegant as the Ten Commandments. So she spends until about 11 a.m. reading, rereading, and understanding the new changes in the project. There are many of these, because this is a Monday morning, and Marietta and her higher-ups spent the whole weekend closeted on the top floor having a catfight about this project, changing everything. Then she starts going back over all the code she has previously written for the project and making a list of all the stuff that will have to be rewritten in order to make it compatible with the new specifications. Basically, she's going to have to rewrite all of her material from the ground up. for the third time in as many months. But hey, it's a job. About 11:30, she looks up, startled to see that half a dozen people are standing around her workstation. There's Marietta, and a proctor, and some male feds, and Leon, the polygraph man. "I've just had mine on Thursday," she says.
"Time for another one," Marietta says. "Come on, let's get this show on the road."
"Hands out where I can see them," the proctor says.
YT's mom stands up, hands to her sides, and starts walking. She walks straight out of the office. None of the other people look up. Not supposed to. Insensitive to co-workers' needs. Makes the testee feel awkward and singled out, when in fact, the polygraph is just part of the whole Fed way of life. She can hear the snapping footsteps of the proctor behind her, walking two paces behind, watching, keeping her eyes on those hands so that they can't be doing anything, like popping a Valium or something else that might throw off the test. She stops in front of the bathroom door. The proctor walks in front of her, holds it open, and she walks in, followed by the proctor. The last stall on the left is oversized, big enough for two people. YT's mom goes in, followed by the proctor, who closes and locks the door. YT's mom pulls down her pantyhose, pulls up her skirt, squats over a pan, pees. The proctor watches every drop go into the pan, picks it up, empties it into a test tube that is already labeled with her name and today's date. Then it's back out to the lobby, followed again by the proctor. You're allowed to use the elevators on your way to the polygraph room, so you won't be out of breath and sweaty when you get there. It used to be just a plain office with a chair and some instruments on a table. Then they got the new, fancy polygraph system. Now it's like going in for some kind of high-tech medical scan. The room is completely rebuilt. No vestige of its original function. The window covered over, everything smooth and beige and smelling like a hospital. There's only one chair, in the middle. YT's mom goes and sits down in it, puts her arms on the arms of the chair, nestles her fingertips and palms into the little depressions that await. The neoprene fist of the blood pressure cuff gropes blindly, finds her arm and seizes it. Meanwhile, the room lights are dimming, the door is closing. She's all alone. The crown of thorns closes over her head. She feels the pricks of the electrodes through her scalp, senses the cool air flowing down over her shoulders from the superconducting quantum interference devices that serve as radar into her brain. Somewhere on the other side of the wall, she knows half a dozen personnel techs are sitting in a control room, looking at a big screen blow-up of her pupils. Then she feels a burning prick in her forearm and knows she's been injected with something, which means it's not a normal polygraph exam. Today she's in for something special. The burning spreads throughout her body. Her heart thumps, eyes water. She's been shot up with caffeine to make her hyper, make her talkative. So much for getting any work done today. Sometimes these things go for 12 hours. "What is your name?" a voice says. It's an unnaturally calm and liquid voice, computer-generated. That way, everything it says to her is impartial, stripped of emotional content. She has no way to pick up any cues as to how the interrogation is going. The caffeine and the other things that they inject her with screw up her sense of time also. She hates these things, but it happens to everyone from time to time. And when you go to work for the feds, you sign on the dotted line and give permission for it. In a way, it's a mark of pride and honor. Everyone who works for the feds has their heart in it, because if they didn't, it would come out plain as day when it is their turn to sit in this chair. The questions go on and on, mostly nonsense questions. "Have you ever been to Scotland? Is white bread more expensive than wheat bread?" This is just to get her settled down, get all systems running smoothly. They throw out all the stuff they get from the first hour of the interrogation because it's lost in the noise. She can feel herself relaxing into it. They say that after a few polygraphs, you learn to relax. The whole thing goes quicker. The chair holds her in place. The caffeine keeps her from getting drowsy. The sensory deprivation clears out her mind.
What is your daughter's nickname?
Y.T.
How do you refer to your daughter?
I call her by her nickname, Y.T. She kind of insists on it.
Does Y.T. have a job?
Yes. She works as a courier. She works for Radic-KS.
How much money does Y.T. make as a courier?
I don't know. A few bucks here and there.
How often does she purchase new equipment for her job?
I'm not aware. I don't really keep track of that.
Has Y.T. done anything unusual lately?
That depends on what you mean.
She knows she's equivocating.
She's always doing things that some people might label as unusual.
That doesn't sound too good. Sounds like an endorsement of nonconformity.
I guess what I'm saying is, she's always doing unusual things.
Has Y.T. broken anything in the house recently?
Yes.
She gives up. The feds already know this. Her house is bugged and tapped. It's a wonder it doesn't short out the electric grid, all the extra stuff wired into it.
She broke my computer.
Did she give an explanation for why she broke the computer?
Yes, sort of. I mean, if nonsense counts as an explanation.
What was her explanation?
She was afraid... This is so ridiculous. She was afraid I was going to catch a virus from it.
Was Y.T. also afraid of catching this virus?
No. She said that only programmers could catch it.
Why are they asking her all of these questions?
They have all of this stuff on tape.
Did you believe Y.T.'s explanation of why she broke the computer? That's it. That's what they're after. They want to know the only thing they can't directly tap. What's going on in her mind? They want to know whether she believes Y.T.'s virus story. And she knows she's making a mistake just thinking these thoughts, because those super-cooled squids around her head are picking it up. They can't tell what she's thinking. But they can tell that something's going on in her brain, that she's using parts of her brain right now that she didn't use when they were asking the nonsense questions. In other words, they can tell that she is analyzing the situation, trying to figure them out, and she wouldn't be doing that unless she wanted to hide something.
What is it you want to know? She says. Why don't you just come out and ask me directly? Let's talk about this face to face. Just sit down together in a room like adults and talk about it.
She feels another sharp prick in her arm, feels numbness and coldness spreading all across her body over an interval of a couple of seconds as the drug mixes with her bloodstream. It's getting harder to follow the conversation. What is your name? The voice says.
Ambangala Manurala.
Yes, Isyama. Yes, you'll be safe.
39. The Alcan, the Alaska Highway, is the world's longest franchise ghetto. A one-dimensional city, 2,000 miles long and 100 feet wide. And growing at the rate of 100 miles a year, or as quickly as people can drive up to the edge of the wilderness and park their bagos in the next available slot. It is the only way out for people who want to leave America but don't have access to an airplane or a ship. It's all two-lane, paved but not well-paved, and choked with mobile homes, family vans, pickup trucks with camper backs. It starts somewhere in the middle of British Columbia at the crossroads of Prince George, where a number of tributaries feed in together to make a single northbound highway. South of there, the tributaries split into a delta of feeder roads that crosses the Canadian-American border at a dozen or more places spread out over 500 miles from the fjords of British Columbia to the vast striped wheatlands of central Montana. Then it ties into the American road system, which serves as the headwaters of the migration.
This 500-mile swath of territory is filled with would-be Arctic explorers in great wheeled houses, optimistically northbound, and more than a few rejects who have abandoned their bagos in the North Country and hitched a ride back down south. The lumbering bagos and top-heavy four-wheelers form a moving slalom course for Hero on his black motorcycle. All these beefy Caucasians with guns. Get enough of them together, looking for the America they always believed they'd grow up in, and they glom together like overcooked rice, form integral, starchy little units. With their power tools, portable generators, weapons, four-wheel drive vehicles, and personal computers, they are like beavers hyped up on crystal meth, manic engineers without a blueprint, chewing through the wilderness, building things and abandoning them, altering the flow of mighty rivers, and then moving on because the place ain't what it used to be. The byproduct of the lifestyle is polluted rivers, greenhouse effect, spouse abuse, televangelists, and serial killers. But as long as you have that four-wheel drive vehicle and keep driving north, you can sustain it. Keep moving just quickly enough to stay one step ahead of your own waste stream. In 20 years, 10 million white people will converge on the North Pole and park their bagos there. The low-grade waste heat of their thermodynamically intense lifestyle will turn the crystalline ice cape pliable and treacherous. It will melt a hole through the polar ice cap, and all that metal will sink to the bottom, sucking the biomass down with it. For a fee, you can drive into a snooze and cruise franchise and umbilical your bago. The magic words are, we have pull-throughs, which means you can enter the franchise, hook up, sleep, unhook, and drive out without ever having to shift your land zeppelin into reverse. They used to claim it was a campground, tried to design the franchise with a rustic motif, but the customers kept chopping up those log and plank signs and wooden picnic tables and using them for cooking fires. Nowadays, the signs are electric polycarbonate bubbles. The corporate identity is all round and polished and smooth in the same way that a urinal is, to prevent stuff from building up in the cracks. Because it's not really camping when you don't have a house to go back to. 16 hours out of California, Hero pulls into a snooze and cruise on the eastern slope of the Cascades in northern Oregon. He's several hundred miles north of where the raft is, and on the wrong side of the mountains. But there's a guy here he wants to interview. There are three parking lots, one out of sight down a pitted dirt road marked with falling down signs, one a little bit closer with scary hairies hanging around its edges, silvery discs flashing and popping under the full moon as they aim the bottoms of their beer cans at the sky, and one right in front of the town hall with gun-toting attendants. You have to pay to park in that lot. Hero decides to pay. He leaves his bike pointing outward, puts the BIOS into warm shutdown so he can hotboot it later if he has to, throws some Kong bucks at an attendant. Then he turns his head back and forth like a hunting dog, sniffing the still air, trying to find the glade. There's an area 100 feet away under the moonlight where a few people have been adventurous enough to pitch a tent. Usually, these are the ones with the most guns, or the least to lose. Hero goes in that direction, and pretty soon he can see the spreading canopy over the glade. Everyone else calls it the body lot. It is simply an open patch of ground, formerly grass-covered, now covered with successive truckloads of sand that have become mingled with litter, broken glass, and human waste. A canopy is stretched over it to keep out the rain, and big mushroom-shaped hoods stick out of the ground every few feet, exhaling warm air on cold nights. It is pretty cheap to sleep in the glade. It is an innovation that was created by some of the franchises farther south, and has been spreading northward along with its clientele. About half a dozen of them are scattered around under the warm air vents, bandaged against the chill in their army blankets. A couple of them have a small fire going, are playing cards by its light. Hero ignores them, starts wandering around through the remainder.
Chuck Wrightson, he says. Mr. President, are you here?
The second time he says it, A pile of wool off to his left begins to writhe and thrash around. A head comes out of it. Hero turns toward him, holds up his hands to prove he's unarmed.
"Who is that?"
he says. He is abjectly terrified.
"Raven?"
"Not Raven," Hero says. "Don't worry. Are you Chuck Wrightson? Former president of the Temporary Republic of Kenai and Kodiak?"
"Yeah. What do you want? I don't have any money."
"Just to talk. I work for CIC, and my job is to gather intelligence."
"I need a fucking drink,"
Chuck Wrightson says.
The town hall is a big inflatable building in the middle of the snoozin' cruise. It is derelict Las Vegas. Convenience store, video arcade, laundromat, bar, liquor store, flea market, whorehouse. It always seems to be ruled by that small percentage of the human population that is capable of partying until 5 a.m. every single night and that has no other function. Most town halls have a few franchises within franchises. Hero sees a Kelly's Tap, which is about the nicest trough you are likely to find at a snoozin' cruise, and leads Chuck Wrightson into it. Chuck is wearing many layers of clothing that used to be different colors. Now they are the same color as his skin, which is khaki. All the businesses in a town hall, including this bar, look like something you'd see on a prison ship. Everything nailed down, brightly lit up 24 hours a day. All of the personnel sealed up behind thick glass barriers that have gone all yellow and murky. Security at this town hall is provided by the enforcers, so there are a lot of steroid addicts in black armor gel outfits cruising up and down the arcade in twos and threes, enthusiastically violating people's human rights. Hero and Chuck grab the closest thing they can find to a corner table. Hero buttonholes a waiter and surreptitiously orders a pitcher of pub special mixed half and half with non-alcoholic beer. This way, Chuck ought to remain awake a little longer than he would otherwise. It doesn't take much to make him open up. He's like one of these old guys from a disgraced presidential administration, forced out by scandal, who devotes the rest of his life to finding people who will listen to him.
"Yeah, I was president of Troc for 2 years, and I still consider myself the president of the government in exile."
Hero tries to keep himself from rolling his eyes. Chuck seems to notice.
Okay, so that's not much. But Troc was a thriving country for a while. There's a lot of people who'd like to see something like that rise again. I mean, the only thing that forced us out, the only way those maniacs were able to seize power, was just totally, you know..."
He doesn't seem to have words for it.
"How could you have expected something like that?"
"How were you forced out? Was there a civil war?"
"There were some uprisings early on. And there were remote parts of Kodiak where we never had a firm grip on power. But there was never a civil war per se. See, the Americans liked our government. The Americans had all the weapons, the equipment, the infrastructure. The Orthos were just a bunch of hairy guys running around in the woods."
"Orthos?"
"Russian Orthodox. At first they were a tiny minority. Mostly Indians, you know, Tlingits and Aleuts who'd been converted by the Russians hundreds of years ago. But when things got crazy in Russia, they started to pour across the date line in all kinds of different boats."
"And they didn't want a constitutional democracy?"
"No, no way."
"What did they want? A czar?"
"No, those czar guys, the traditionalists, stayed in Russia. The Orthos who came to Troc were total rejects. They had been forced out by the mainline Russian Orthodox Church."
"Why?"
"Heretic. That's how Russians say heretic. The Orthos who came to Troc were a new sect, all Pentecostals. They were tied in somehow with the Reverend Wayne's pearly gates. We had missionaries from Texas coming up all the goddamn time to meet with them. They were always speaking in tongues. The mainline Russian Orthodox Church thought it was the work of the devil."
"So how many of these Pentecostal Russian Orthodox people came over to Troc?" Jeez, a hell of a lot of them. At least 50,000. How many Americans were in Trak?
Close to 100,000.
Then how exactly did the Orthos manage to take the place over?
Well, one morning we woke up, and there was an airstream parked in the middle of Government Square in New Washington, right in the middle of all the bagos where we had set up the government. The Orthos had towed it there during the night, then took the wheels off so it couldn't be moved. We figured it was a protest action. We told them to move it out of there. They refused and issued a proclamation in Russian. When we got this damn thing translated, it turned out to be an order for us to pack up and leave and turn over power to the Orthos. Well, this was ridiculous. So we went up to this airstream to move it out of there, and Gurov's waiting for us with this nasty grin on his face.
Gurov?
Yeah. One of the refugees who came over the dateline from the Soviet Union. Former KGB general turned religious fanatic. He was kind of like the Minister of Defense for the government that the Orthos set up. So Gurov opens the side door of the airstream and lets us get a load of what's inside.
What was inside?
Well, mostly it was a bunch of equipment, you know. A portable generator, electrical wiring, a control panel, and so forth. But in the middle of the trailer, there's this big black cone sitting on the floor. About the shape of an ice cream cone, except it's about 5 feet long and it's smooth and black. And I ask, what the hell is that thing? And Gurov says, that thing is a 10-megaton hydrogen bomb we scavenged from a ballistic missile. A city buster. Any more questions?
So you capitulated?
Couldn't do much else.
Do you know how the Orthos came to be in possession of a hydrogen bomb? Chuck Wrightson clearly knows. He sucks in his deepest breath of the evening, lets it out, shakes his head, staring off over Hero's shoulder. He takes a couple of nice long swigs from his glass of beer.
There was a Soviet nuclear missile submarine. The commander was named Ovchinnikov. He was religiously faithful, but he wasn't a fanatic like the Orthos. I mean, if he had been a fanatic, they wouldn't have given him command of a nuclear missile submarine, right?
Supposedly.
You had to be psychologically stable, whatever that means. Anyway, after things fell apart in Russia, he found himself in possession of this very dangerous weapon. He made up his mind that he was going to offload all of the crew and then scuttle it in the Marianas Trench, bury all those weapons forever. But somehow, he was persuaded to use this submarine to help a bunch of the Orthos escape to Alaska. They, and a lot of other refuse, had started flocking to the Bering coast. And the conditions in some of these refuge camps were pretty desperate. It's not like a lot of food can be grown in that area, you know. These people were dying by the thousands. They just stood on the beaches, starving to death, waiting for a ship to come. So Ovchinnikov let himself be persuaded to use his submarine, which is very large and very fast, to evacuate some of these poor refuse to Trak. But naturally he was paranoid about the idea of letting a whole bunch of unknown quantities onto his ship. These nuke subcommanders are real security freaks, for obvious reasons. So they set up a very strict system. All the refuse who were going to get on the ship had to pass through metal detectors, had to be inspected. Then they were under armed guard all the way across to Alaska. Well, the stern Orthos have this guy named Raven.
I'm familiar with him.
Well, Raven got onto that nuclear submarine.
Oh my God.
He got over to the Siberian coast somehow. Probably surfed across in his fucking kayak.
Surfed?
That's how the Aleuts get between islands.
Ravens and Aleut?
Yeah, an Aleut whale killer. You know what an Aleut is.
Yeah, my dad knew one in Japan, Hero says. A bunch of Dad's old prison camp tales are beginning to stir in Hero's memory, working their way up out of deep, deep storage.
The Aleuts just paddle out in their kayaks and catch a wave. They can outrun a steamship, you know?
Didn't know that.
Anyway, Raven went to one of these refugee camps and passed himself off as a Siberian tribesman. You can't tell some of those Siberians apart from our Indians. The Orthos apparently had some Confederates in these camps who bumped Raven up to the head of the line, so he got to be on the submarine.
But you said there was a metal detector.
Didn't help. He uses glass knives, chips them out of plate glass. It's the sharpest blade in the universe, you know?
Didn't know that either.
Yeah. The edge is only a single molecule wide. Doctors use them for eye surgery. They can cut your cornea and not leave a scar. There's Indians who make a living doing that, you know, chipping out eye scalpels.
Well, you learn something new every day. That kind of knife would be sharp enough to go through bulletproof fabric, I guess, Hero says. Chuck writes and shrugs.
I lost track of the number of people Raven snuffed were wearing bulletproof fabric.
Hero says, I thought he must be carrying some kind of high-tech laser knife or something.
Think again. Glass knife. He had one on board the submarine. Either smuggled it on board with him or else found the chunk of glass on the submarine and chipped it out himself.
And? Chuck gets his thousand-yard stare again, takes another slug of beer.
On a sub, you know, there's no place for things to drain to. The survivors claimed that the blood was knee-deep all through the submarine. Raven just killed everyone. Everyone except the Orthos, a skeleton crew, and some other refuse who were able to barricade themselves in little compartments around the ship. The survivors say,
Chuck says, taking another swig,
that it was quite a night.
And he forced them to steer the submarine into the hands of the Orthos.
To their anchorage off Kodiak, Chuck says. The Orthos were all ready. They had put together a crew of ex-Navy men, guys who had worked on nuke subs in the past. X-rays, they called them. And they came and took the sub over. As for us, we had no idea that any of this had happened. Until one of the warheads showed up in our goddamn front yard.
Chuck glances up above Hero's head, noticing someone. Hero feels a light tap on his shoulder.
Excuse me, sir, a man is saying. Pardon me for just a second.